In his new book, After the Fact, The Erosion of Truth and the Inevitable Rise of Donald Trump, USA Business reporter Nathan Bomey writes that, and I quote, "Donald Trump did not usher the post-fact era into existence. He was a product of it. He was its inevitable outcome." To discuss this key theme and others, it is a pleasure to welcome Nathan back to our program. Nathan, first, congratulations on the new book just out and published by Prometheus Books.
Thank you so much. Always love talking to you guys, so I appreciate the chance to come on.
Well, this is your second book. The first was the acclaimed Detroit Resurrected to Bankruptcy and Back, and now you're looking at The Erosion of Truth. You agree with scholars and commentators, many of whom you quote in the book, that we are in a post-truth society and that political misinformation and disinformation, just one manifestation of post-truth society. What do you mean by post-truth society?
Well, you know, that's it was a buzzword, you know, the word of the year by the Oxford Dictionary in 2016, but I think that it actually does adequately describe this environment in which we have seen this transfer of truth from, you know, journalism and, you know, authenticated information to social media algorithms and ideological political groups that now are governing what we see and hear. And I think that it's a really dangerous place to be, because when, you know, you've got social media like Facebook that decides what we see and what we don't see, then that ultimately leads us down a road toward, you know, isolation. And I think that that's dangerous. And, you know, unfortunately, the algorithms are designed to surface information that is sensational or engaging and often, you know, causes us to have various emotions. Many times that means we get angry. And when we get angry, then we're much more susceptible to manipulation. And so, you know, I think it's all a constellation of factors that has led us to a point that where, you know, it's getting harder and harder to sort fact from fiction. And unfortunately, I see, you know, this getting worse before it gets any better.
I thought particularly compelling early in the book, you talk about the genesis of this post-truth society that led up to this Donald Trump phenomenon. But it started, as I recall, either with Facebook or Google. Yeah.
Yeah, I think Facebook was a key factor. I think you can't underestimate the effect that Facebook has had on the way people perceive the world. You know, I think that a lot of us don't understand the sheer scale of Facebook, more than 2 billion users. And, you know, we're talking about a company that affects the way people actually perceive what is happening and the way they look at their friends and their family. And this has gone far beyond any single news outlet or any other outlet that actually covers the news. So, you know, I think that, you know, obviously Facebook has been significant, but Google as well, because if you were to design a tool that actually would, you know, help people, let's put it this way, if you were to design a tool for confirmation bias to make it worse, this is what you design, because what Google does is it basically provides you a way to discover the facts that you want to discover. It does not, you know, present to you alternative perspectives. It presents to you what you want to know. And certainly you can find alternative perspectives if you're looking for them. But usually people, you know, click on the first link. In fact, I cite some studies in the book that show that, you know, people are very likely to click on the first, second, or third link on Google. They don't go any farther than that. In fact, on mobile phone, less than 1 in 400 people go to the second page. So if your truth isn't at the top of the Google results page, then good luck getting your word out there.
You mentioned the research and the people you quote. I would be remiss, but the book is extremely well researched. Not only do you quote a lot of recent academic studies, but you have had a lot of interviews with people in the social media industry, a lot of people in other industries as well, people in the metrics industry, which is tracking all of this stuff.
Yeah, it's really interesting. If you look at, you know, I'm in obviously the news industry now, and I'm sort of obviously cognizant of the way that metrics have affected news coverage and seen some of my colleagues and the effect it's had on them. And, you know, there's a tool in the news industry called Chartbeat that helps thousands and thousands of news organizations, all the credible ones, the New York Times, you know, USA Today, all of us really, track what people are reading. Now, there are two ways that you can use metrics. One is to help guide you to make sensible decisions about what to cover, and the other is to tilt into more sensational coverage. And unfortunately, a lot of outlets out there are using it to get more sensational and get more distance from the truth. And so I can't exonerate journalism. You know, I believe good, sound journalism is critical to reorienting back toward the truth. And I think that all of the president's, accusations of fake news are really irresponsible and disheartening. However, we can't exonerate, journalism that has gotten too distanced from the truth as well. So I think that we need to take a look inward and say, we need to use metrics responsibly, and I think a lot of national outlets like my own are doing that. But unfortunately, even some venerable brands such as Newsweek, for example, Newsweek has come under fire for basically, unfortunately, using it to do clickbait. And so I think that we have to understand that that journalism has a responsibility to keep people focused on news that matters, not just news they want to know, news they need to know.
My guest is Nathan Bomey. He is the author of a book just out. It's called After the Fact, The Erosion of Truth and the Inevitable Rise of Donald Trump, available virtually everywhere, and it's published by Prometheus Books. Nathan is also a business reporter for USA Today. Nathan, your book is divided into three parts, and we want people to buy the book, and I recommend it heartily. And as usual, it's exceedingly well written. But in your last section, the disrupted section, you look at some ways that we might get beyond this post-truth phenomenon, this culture that we're in. So you end on a hopeful note, and I don't want to give away all of what you have to offer, but because this program is MSU Today, Michigan State has a historically strong journalism program. I mean, what are the role of educational institutions, particularly journalism programs in high school and college, to help us move beyond this malaise?
I think it's huge. I really do believe, and I'm still a millennial, Kirk, so I am naive enough to think maybe there are some solutions out there that we can pursue, and I do think education is one of them, K-12, but also colleges. I really believe need to make this a key priority, which is understanding that we no longer live in an environment in which people are picking up the daily newspaper and and trusting journalists to authenticate information for them. We live in an environment in which we all need to do this for ourselves. And so I think that for educators, that means that it's important to teach critical thinking skills, but also to understand that students have to be lifelong learners and have to immerse themselves in controversial information and help them to sort through it and question themselves, question their sources. They have to actually be sort of like journalists on their own. And so I advocate for more education about the basic principles of good journalism, which is authenticating the source of the material and questioning, basically, having a healthy dose of skepticism. And so, unfortunately, we can't expect that everyone will come to our news websites and read the stories and trust us. They are on their own, and people are busy, and so, they're on social media, and I think that we see technology coming. It's going to make it easier and easier to do fake video and fake audio and things like that that will just make it so that we have to be skeptical. And so I really believe educators can do a good job of training people on journalism principles. I don't think we should expect everyone to become a journalist, but I think that we can expect people to understand the basic principles of journalism, because that's what they're going to need to sort through this post-fact era.
Back in the old days when I was a college student at Albion, it was when we had controversial issues in philosophy or history or what have you, it was a matter of the professor would provide us with multiple points of view, and generally they were books or articles, and then we would go to the library and we would read all these conflicting points of view about a particular issue, and then we'd come back to class and discuss them. But with the plethora of social media outlets for news and information, how do you teach the tools just to wade through the material even before you begin to try and assess what is factual and what isn't?
Well, I think it is tough, and I do think Google and Facebook make it easier to avoid information that you don't want to see. You know, this is an environment in which you can customize your newsfeed and your email inbox to basically avoid information that makes you uncomfortable. But, I actually had this fascinating interview for the book with the editor of the Weekly World News, which is, of course, a supermarket tabloid, you know, famous for reporting about aliens and, you know, Bat Boy in a West Virginia cave. But I had talked to him about, you know, this is like fake news before fake news, you know. And I asked him, I said, why does it have an appeal to people? Like, why does it have this just fundamental human appeal? And he said, because reality is inconvenient. And people don't really want to deal with reality sometimes because it makes them uncomfortable and it may contradict their beliefs about the world. And so I guess the solution, if I were to say, it would be we have to, in our education, we have to start saying, it's a good thing to confront material that contradicts your beliefs, and we have to actually come to the table and have debates and arguments and discussions about misinformation and about the other side, because frankly, I'm too idealistic about the world, but I really think that the only way for us to bridge some of the divides in our society are to have relationships and to discussions and to actually come to mutual respect, even if we can't come to agreement.
And in the book, you say that social media has a responsibility itself to try and bring those kinds of dialogues together.
They really do. And unfortunately, I'm not sure that commitment is there. You know, Facebook is talking right now about trying to, basically encourage more thoughtful content and conversation. The problem is that one of the ways that Facebook plans to do this is by encouraging more groups. And unfortunately, what I've shown in the book is that research is clear that the grouping mindset is actually a big part of the problem, that we have isolated groups in society of ideological means, and oftentimes that are often the ones that are responsible for skewing the facts. And this is not just about politics. You know, I actually look at the anti-vaccination community, for example, that isn't really about politics. In fact, you see a very interesting mix of people there. You see some liberal and some conservative, but they band together and they group together, and that allows them to sort of continue to circulate the misinformation about vaccines. And so if you look at that, and that shows this isn't just political. This is a very human thing. And I think, unfortunately, groups are not the solution to making sure that people actually communicate and see the facts.
One thing that was particularly fascinating for me is towards the end of the book, and you were talking about this, what you call the craving for authenticity. I was struck by that discussion. Because it connected and underscored some insights about Trump supporters and even liberal groups that I'm aware of. But for Trump supporters that I gleaned from reading books like The Hillbilly Elegy and Strangers in Their Own Land, that these are good, authentic people who felt betrayed. I mean, you've got all this in your book, by government and leaders, felt left behind. And so they kind of need a hero, and they need a gladiator. And it doesn't matter that he doesn't tell the truth, because they think he's authentic.
Yeah, I do think authenticity sells now more than ever, because we're this world that's swirling with misinformation and falsities. You know, people, they crave that authentic experience. And that's why it works in marketing, for example. You know, when you can portray yourself as authentic, that works. And I just think the problem is that social media makes it easy to imitate authenticity, like you say. And again, this cuts both ways. And so, it's just difficult, because when, even in our personal lives, you know, one of the things I'm concerned about personally is the way that we as individuals will sort of misportray our lives on social media. And so I think personally that contributes to this, because there's research that shows people are more likely to get depressed when they use Facebook longer. And so that then can lead to people preying upon our emotions. And, you know, I think that leads to this contemporary face of isolation, which is one of the titles of one of my chapters, because I genuinely feel like that is a political issue as well.
Well, and one of the things your book does, and correct me if I'm wrong, but trying to reconnect truthfulness and authenticity like it was back in the day when those things were inseparable.
Yeah, and you know, I wish I could say I'm optimistic. You know, I have to say I'm slightly pessimistic, if only because, you know, okay, so I'm 34 years old, so I'm old enough to remember life before the internet. Actually, older millennials, they say, are the last subsegment of Americans who will remember life before the internet. And so I remember that. And I remember, you know, in middle school, free copies of the Ann Arbor News, you know, when I was living in Saline, were delivered to our school, and, you know, reading the newspaper. And I think when you had, you know, a trusted source of information that was dedicated to sorting through the facts, you know, I think that that was, and although not a perfect world because journalists make mistakes, it was better in the sense that it provided, because the issue is that journalists are trained to sort fact from fiction, and the rest of us, we have jobs, you know, like people have, they have things to do, and so they kind of relied upon professional journalists to do that. And now, unfortunately, a lot of, you know, subscriptions, most people don't subscribe to a newspaper or trust the, you know, cable news, and so they're out there on their own, and I think it's a recipe for disaster.
Nathan, you mentioned Saline. You are a native of Saline. You're also a very proud graduate of Eastern Michigan University. You've also won a number of awards, and I'm not going to read them all, but 2 Society of American Business Editors and Writers Awards, the Wade McCree Award for the Advancement of Justice, a Young Alumni Award from your alma mater. I mean, it just rocks right along for you.
Well, my heart is still in Michigan. You know, I'm a Michigan kid, born, you know, raised in Michigan, from Saline, like you say. Of course, the Detroit Free Press was good to me, and, you know, covering the Detroit bankruptcy was one of the most fascinating experiences of my career so far. So I am a Michigander through and through.
One last question, because, again, back to the fact that this is MSU Today, but for young people listening to this interview who might be looking at a career in journalism, or parents who know that their children might be interested in a career in journalism, I have a very, very good friend whose daughter may be the editor of the state news here next year as a sophomore. But what would you say to the young people that, given all of the things that you account for in your book with regard to challenges for the industry, I mean, what should they know?
We need great journalism more now than ever, you know, and I think that this is, in some ways, one of the most exciting times to go into journalism, because it allows you to tackle some of these incredibly important issues and to make a difference. On the other hand, I think it's also one of the most challenging times to get into journalism because of all the cuts that are happening throughout the industry. It's no secret that there have been layoffs, you know, really throughout the industry, affecting most every publication and news outlet. So I think it's tough, but, you know, I think I would say this. I am hopeful for nonprofit journalism in particular. I think that you see signs of organizations like the Knight Foundation and others that are investing in nonprofit journalism, and I think that's really important. You know, Bridge, for example, in Michigan is a great outlet that does a lot of nonprofit journalism, and it's important because then when you don't have to pay the bills, the economic, you know, the bills, so to speak, then you can focus a little bit more on some of the reporting that you might need to help keep the public officials accountable, for example. So I think that that's really important, and I'm hopeful that we'll see more and more opportunities there that'll provide jobs for young people, because we really need it.
Well, on that optimistic note, we conclude the interview. I've been talking with Nathan Bomey, a U.S. business reporter, USA Today business reporter, also the author of a book just out, After the Fact, The Erosion of Truth and the Inevitable Rise of Donald Trump, published by Prometheus Books. Nathan, it's all these years, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. You've been a regular guest on this program, and I can't even guess what you're going to do next.
I don't know either. So if you had a good idea, let me know. I'm just excited to continue to be reporting here, and journalism is still so much fun. So I'm having a good time.
Well, we'll continue to read you in USA Today, and you have a blog as well, right?
I do. I mean, probably the best way to always follow anything I'm writing is just to follow me on Twitter at Nathan Bomey. You can see everything I do there.
At Nathan Bomey. Nathan, always a pleasure talking to you. Best of luck going forward.
All right. Hey, thanks, guys.